Welcome everyone to the morning session. It's my honor to introduce Irina Risch. Irina is a senior research scientist at Healthcare and Life Sciences Department at IBM T.J. Watson Research Center. Irina received her PhD in computer science at University of California, Irvine. She's an expert in artificial intelligence and machine learning, primarily focusing on probabilistic graphical models, sparsity and compressed sensing, active learning, information theory, and she has done a lot of amazing work in the space of computational biology and neuroscience, particularly focusing on brain imaging data such as fMRI data. So let's welcome Irina, and thank you for coming.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you for kind introduction. It's actually great to be back to Barcelona. I've been here only once before to European Machine Learning Conference, and it's great to be back. And I really would like to thank organizers for inviting me. It's a great honor to give a talk to such a NIPS audience, and NIPS is growing exponentially, as we all noticed. So as Ruslan mentioned, I'm a researcher at IBM T.J. Watson in New York. And our group works primarily on applications of machine learning and statistics to biology and neuroscience. And the name of the group, actually the new name, is Computational Psychiatry and Neuroimaging. I'll talk a little bit about computational psychiatry. I think it's a new and fascinating field that we should all learn more about. I know people usually put thanks to collaborators at the end, but I tend to run late, so just in case, I decided to put collaborators first and thank all of them, and this is incomplete list, because I had a pleasure and privilege of working with many great people over the past several years in neuroscience, in machine learning, in systems, and other fields, so the work is really multidisciplinary, I would say. So what is this talk about? In a sense, it's not just a roadmap of the talk. It's kind of a vision of our whole group at AI to brain and brain to AI, where by AI to brain, I mean applications of machine learning primarily to neuroscience, to neuroimaging, with the goal of better understanding how brain works. And this includes not just learning accurate predictors, but also extracting so-called biomarkers or statistical biomarkers or features that can help neuroscientists learn something new about how brain works. The other direction is brain to AI, and this is of particular interest to this crowd because it's bio-inspired machine learning. And there are still many, many ideas that machine learning can actually borrow from how brain works. Yeah, we're all well aware of success of deep learning, but there are so many things to be modeled more precisely, such as memory and attention and adult neurogenesis that I'm going to mention at the end, and so on and so forth. So I'll start with AI to brain direction, and we'll talk probably for first 20 or 30 minutes, yeah, Ruslan will stop me, about applying machine learning to reconstruction, to mind reading, to reconstruction of mental states from various data, from various sensors. And the objective is not just to understand brain better, but hopefully improve mental function. One classical and huge application, as I mentioned, is computational psychiatry. What does it mean? Essentially, it means applying data-driven approaches with objective measurements at hand to the field of psychiatry, which is still a little bit in 20th century. So it's still kind of going to a doctor, talking about your symptoms, the doctor thinking about diagnostic statistical manual, a book which kind of uses symptoms to diagnose patient. It's quite subjective. So bringing objective measurements to this field would be actually bringing psychiatry to the 21st century. And it's quite urgent to the point that many people recognize that actually psychiatry is in crisis. There are many, many other applications, and many of them also go beyond the fMRI scanner and could use various cheaper measurements such as wearable devices, other sensors, including text and speech. And those applications I will mention at the end as well, but you can think about trying to monitor people's stress or anxiety level, or trying to monitor their reaction to, for example, inefficient software to improve productivity. Another application, obviously, is trying to monitor mental state of a driver, a truck driver, a train driver, because we all know too well that there are multiple accidents caused by lack of attention or lack of sleep or other kind of states that should not be appropriate for operator of a vehicle. And there are many, many more other applications where mind reading would be useful. Response to different news, different advertisements, you name it, the whole field that people call neuromarketing and so on. So let's start with a most classical type of sensors for mind reading, functional MRI. So by now it's a mature field. It's been more than 20 years. And the invention of a fMRI was actually a great progress towards learning about brain with non-invasive measurements. The previous types of imaging, such as PET, were somewhat more invasive because they involved radioactive chemicals that has to enter a system. fMRI is least invasive in this sense, and it actually measures what's called a blood oxygen level dependent signal in the brain. And loosely speaking, when certain areas of the brain are more active, there is more blood flow there, and there is higher level of oxygen, and that's being detected by fMRI scanner. Typical experiments that people do with fMRI is giving some task to a subject in a scanner, for example, asking a person to read sentence or look at the picture, collecting the data, and trying to see what is the difference between mental states when the person is reading a sentence or looking at the image, and so on and so forth. How does the data look like? It's basically a brain movie where you have multiple time points, usually over 5 to 10 minutes a person spends in scanner. The time resolution perhaps is not so great, but depends for what purpose. The measurements are taken roughly 1 to 2 seconds apart, which is, of course, too slow to detect actual neuronal activity, but maybe just fine for detecting slower changes, such as emotional changes, cognitive changes, because also the scale of the spatial scale is far from being fine-grained neuronal scale. Each voxel, or three-dimensional element of the image, may consist of millions of neurons. And it's fine. It's very indirect measurement of activity, and yet, surprisingly, it has a lot of signal about mental states, as we will see later. However, this data are quite challenging because they are definitely very high-dimensional, say on the order of 10 to 100,000 voxels, which typically serve as variables when people approach the data analysis task. But the number of samples during one trial, for example, is on the order of a few hundreds. Also, if you're trying to compare different subjects, for example, classifying controls versus people with schizophrenia, or controls with versus people with cocaine addiction and so on, the number of subjects is typically small. It used to be on the order of dozens. Now it's getting better on the order of hundreds, and there is a great push in the field of neuroimaging to actually get to the point when neuroimaging will have big data. So there are more data sets, more publicly available ones. It's getting there. But still, the challenge remains. It's high dimensional, but relatively small sample. So how do fMRI experiments look like, and what kind of questions people are asking? For example, a typical experiment. This is a data coming from our collaborators from Northwestern University, Vanya Apkarian and his group. 14 graduate students are placed in the scanner and subjected to a painful stimulus. It's really great to have graduate students you can use for experiments. The painful stimulus is thermal. They put metal patch on their lower back and heat it according to the profile in that picture. So basically, you see the temperature profile going up and down, up and down. And then subjects are asked to rate their pain perception during the experiment. And those time series, 14 different time series, you see on the right. The interesting thing is actually how much of an inter-subject variability is there. You can see some people who are quite sensitive and pretty much reflect their changes in temperature very accurately. Some people are so-so, and there are several really tough guys. They don't seem to feel anything. A bit later, I will explain that it's not tough versus whining. It's rather certain parameters of dynamical system that capture inter-subject variability. But what type of question people ask? What brain area may be relevant to pain or brain areas? Is there a brain area where the information is distributed? How distributed? Can you predict pain perception from the data, not just compare using statistical significance tests, pain, no pain? So this is one example and set of questions that people typically ask in the field. Another example, cocaine addiction. Well, this is joint work with our colleagues at Mount Sinai in New York City. Well, they have plenty of subjects for this study. The mechanism of cocaine addiction is well known. Basically, cocaine affects the reward system and kind of binds to dopamine transporters, so there is more dopamine left floating around between neurons, and people feel good. There is another chemical called methylphenidate, and the actual brand name Ritalin. That's a drug that is usually given to kids with ADHD. I was actually really surprised to learn that chemical structure of Ritalin is very similar to cocaine. Mechanism of action is pretty much the same, and the only difference that methylphenidate has is much slower working agent. It has a half-life of 90 instead of 20 minutes, so it doesn't create high, and therefore people supposedly don't get addicted to it. So the good question people are asking in the field is, can you actually use stimulant for stimulant? Can you try and treat addiction with such stimulant as Ritalin? And this is not the first time people ask this question. Similar treatments are used for nicotine addiction, well, nicotine patch, or for heroin and so on. So one example of experiment to answer this question would be, for example, to put cocaine addicts and controls in a scanner, and even do the resting state experiment. They don't have to do any task. They can just lay down and do nothing. But it's not the right name. It's not really a resting state, because even without any external stimulus, brain is extremely active all the time, doing multiple things. But resting state is a common way to kind of explore different disorders. And for example, prior work of our colleagues used functional connectivity, which I describe in detail later, to see whether there are clear differences between cocaine addicts and controls, as well as effect of methylphenidate. To make a long story short, it's still an introduction. Yes, methylphenidate can actually normalize brain activity in cocaine addicts. And you can not only see it in the standard univariate analysis using like statistical hypothesis testing in particular brain areas, you can actually use machine learning approaches to like whole brain patterns and show that under methylphenidate, the brain of cocaine addicts becomes much less distinguishable or discriminated from controls. So it's just kind of another example of a problem, an experiment in the field. So what are we typically looking for in functional MRI data? The typical question is, you're given stimulus or task or condition or mental state or disorder, and you want to know which patterns in the brain relate to this task or disorder. And traditional approach has been for many years in the field to use so-called generalized linear model, or GLM, which essentially measures univariate correlation between task or stimulus and brain activity in every separate voxel. So essentially it treats voxels independently of each other, which is obviously a huge oversimplification since the brain is interconnected and works as a whole network. Therefore, about a decade ago, or actually more, multivariate predictive methods and machine learning came to the field, and starting with pioneering work by Tom Mitchell, James Huxby, and others, multivariate predictive methods became pretty much the core of current neuroimaging statistical analysis. And as I said, you can be asking questions about cognitive state, emotional state, disorders, and so on and so forth. But there is an important point to keep in mind here. You're looking for predictive patterns rather than just an accurate predictor. So black box models might be less of a value in this field. Just to reiterate on what I just said, our focus is on interpretable machine learning. Actually, it's not just neuroimaging. I think any scientific field or, for example, biology and neuroscience as examples, the final goal is to understand something about the system at hand, such as brain or other parts of nature. And for that, you really would like to use predictive methods that are very accurate, say, discriminating controls versus patients, but they also provide you with predictive features or biomarkers that made them so predictive. So your focus is not just at the right side of this picture with predictive accuracy, but rather in the middle on biomarkers. And there are many approaches to this problem, which I'm going to go over in this talk, starting from very obvious and simple feature selection. The classical feature selection techniques involve sparsity constraints, which essentially means when you build a model, you also try to select predictive variables at the same time. It's so-called embedded variable selection, with lasso and extensions of that to various structured sparsity methods being a classical tool of choice, pretty much a workhorse in many biological domains. Well, the next step is, what if the original features or voxel activations are not necessarily the most informative ones? And what if you have some good domain knowledge about what might be important for discriminating, say, schizophrenia from controls? What if you know from prior knowledge that networks are disrupted? It's only natural then to look at network features. So the feature engineering from prior knowledge is still quite important in this type of applications. Although, next comes, of course, automated feature extraction, whether it's dictionary learning, autoencoders, deeper networks, and so on, but basically creating and learning representations directly from data. So I will give examples of each of those approaches to creating biomarkers, pretty much in this order. Okay, let's consider a very simple linear sparse regression model, particularly in application to fMRI data. In this linear model, matrix A is a fat matrix with small, relatively small number of rows corresponding to time points, and the columns corresponding to different voxels. Remember, there are 10 to 100,000 such voxels, and there are a few hundreds of time points. Y is the output you're trying to predict. It could be your pain rating, it could be stimulus such as temperature, it could be something else. So Y is a mental state you're trying to investigate with this data. So you're trying to learn the linear regression model, but as I said, the problem is the data high dimensional, small sample, you can easily overfit, plus you want to find interpretable solution, so sparsity actually kills two birds with the same stone. I know that probably most of you in this audience know well what sparse regression is, but just to refresh our memory, I wanted to mention that the good old basic lasso introduced by Tipchirani in 1996, also known as basis pursuit in compressed sensing and signal processing fields, was introduced by Chen, Saunders, and Donohue in 98, I think. It's a very simple extension of linear regression with L1 regularization, which is known to impose sparsity by setting many coefficients of regression to zero and therefore selecting those non-zeros which are most important for prediction. However, it has various limitations, and in biological applications, people usually don't like the fact that lasso tends to choose one variable out of a cluster of highly correlated variables. They would like to see the whole cluster, whether it's biology, like gene array analysis, or neuroimaging. You would like the grouping to be part of the variable selection. And that's where extension called the elastic net came in, which keeps sparsity and imposes grouping by combining two regularizers, L1 and L2. It's an extremely simple approach, but surprisingly, it turned out to be very useful in many bioapplications in the past decade. Just to summarize how actually useful adding extra structure or the grouping constraint could be, I just wanted to mention that, first of all, in terms of predictive accuracy for the pain experiment that I mentioned before, it's amazing that such a subjective feeling as pain can be quite accurately predicted using elastic net model on fMRI data for most of the subjects. I'm not saying that everyone is so predictable, and it definitely was more predictable using elastic net than using the lasso. It's like 0.8 correlation between actual pain and the predicted pain. Also, grouping introduced more interpretability by showing us clusters that are relevant to pain instead of showing salt and pepper kind of individual voxels, which are very hard to show to your neuroscientist colleague. They don't want to see such pictures. They're not very interpretable. And moreover, grouping also improved stability of the model, which is essential, again, in not just imaging, but any biological applications. You would like your model, whatever you select as important variables, to be stable, ideally across subjects and across runs. There are, of course, many other ways to impose more structure on sparsity, including group loss, fused loss, and so on and so forth. And there is lots of literature in the field now exploring those variations. So bottom line here is important to, thank you, it's important to keep structure in place. I guess I have to really speed up now. Another lesson I wanted to mention is actually introducing analytical model may be really helpful. For example, the intersubject variability was nicely captured by dynamical model with only three parameters, essentially capturing pain threshold, forgetting, and anticipation. And combining this model with data-driven model, we get much more accurate prediction of pain than before. Another point is that, though I was talking about sparsity, you cannot just stop looking at one optimal solution, and you need to keep exploring, because you may find that there are many nearly optimal solutions that predict similarly well, and this picture was comparing a simple task from different experiment, which was truly sparse, and solution quality of subsequent sparse solutions was declining fast. Therefore, the task was truly local, and so-called holographic or distributed representation of kind of stimulus, in this case it was pain, where the solution quality on the right was degrading very slowly. What I'm trying to say that you need to keep searching for other sparse solutions, and it might happen that you might exhaust the whole brain and you still find predictive ones. And just to note, if you look at univariate correlations using standard GLM approach, then those solutions that are still quite predictive, the blue one and the green one, univariately, each voxel has below 0.1 correlation. You will never see them with standard techniques. The next topic was, as I mentioned, feature engineering. And again, I'll try to really speed up now. But it was an interesting case study with schizophrenia when we knew that schizophrenia is not a localized disorder. It's a network disease. The whole the actual name of schizophrenia means disconnection. Something is wrong with the network. Indeed, when we used network-based features, a network was essentially just a correlation matrix across voxels, thresholded, you can measure degrees, you can measure actual link weights, those features were much, much more predictive, discriminative, than the standard activation features. They were also statistically significant, and they are also more stable. So this is a lesson where using prior and expert knowledge about the disease can help you design better features. Another example was going beyond correlation-based networks and trying to actually learn sparse Markov networks of the brain. If you use standard methods like a graphical lasso, you get a picture on the right, which is a total mess. Although it's edge sparse, it involves all the voxels, and you cannot see anything and interpret anything in this picture. However, if you actually introduce additional constraint or additional prior using group sparsity, and actually you try to delete nodes and all the adjacent edges using group sparsity, you get much cleaner picture. That was actually tested in the experiment with cocaine addicts again in some task setting. The bottom line I'm trying to say here that if you use additional prior or that group sparsity on the edges, you get much cleaner picture on the top comparing to the standard graphical lasso approach at the bottom, just because you removed nodes that are less important for explaining the data. Not only get you higher likelihood, you get higher interpretability, and the connections you can actually look at and interpret, and they seem to connect with the prior art on what we know about cocaine addiction and on what kind of disturbances it implies. Finally, I wanted to make sure I get to this point because I'm sure it's going to be of interest to most of you. So finally, I'm talking about deep learning. Sparsity is so yesterday, right? This was experiment, we're kind of changing gears a little bit. Experiment with EEG, not fMRI. So electroencephalogram, you have classical medical-grade device. If I have time, I'll talk about wearables as well. But just to make the long story short, you have certain subjects and you're trying to measure from their EEG their mental load level. The experiment basically consists in showing them a collection of letters from 2 to 4 to 6 to 8. And as you can see, if you have to remember 8, it's more of a cognitive or kind of memory load than if you have to remember 2. And then you have to say whether a particular letter was in the set or not. So there are actually four classes, four levels of memory load. And what we did, it's actually recent this year ICLR paper with my student Poya Pashivan, who is now actually at MIT. We actually transformed EEG time series by using distance-preserving projection to 2D images plus every frequency, actually there were three important frequencies here related to this task, alpha, beta, and theta. They were mapped into different colors, so you get RGB images, and you get the whole movie of those images. So now you have EEG brain movie, and you ask the question, can you classify movies into four different classes? So naturally, you start looking for good architectures in convolutional networks, and particularly recurrent convolutional networks, that could handle this problem. And this is kind of outline of what we did. Once you transform the data into those images, you feed them into the network that I'll describe in the next slide, and you end up actually beating state-of-art performance on this data set that existed in the literature. I might not be able to go into all details, but we tried multiple convolutional network architectures first without taking time into account, just kind of averaging the data over the whole trial, looking at the image, and just trying to classify those images. Well, bottom line, to make the long story short, the convolutional network with seven layers turned out to be the best and outperformed the shallower ones. And the next important step was actually to add time because it was a movie. And here we used some state-of-the-art approaches from video classification and essentially ended up with the best performing architecture, which would combine LSTM units and also temporal convolution on top of convolutional networks, the best performing seven-layer architecture that I described before. This combination of time and space turned out to be capturing the properties of this EEG data in the best way and basically being the winning configuration, definitely beating standard approaches like SVM and L1 regularized logistic regression by basically close to like 7% or something like that. So there was a huge gap in performance. But what about interpretability? Because I kept talking about the importance of mapping your statistical model back to brain in order to answer questions that neuroscientists might be interested about. And here we had to use the convolution approach. There are actually probably more approaches right now, since with convolutional networks, it's a bit trickier than with fully connected networks to map features back to the original data. But essentially, the nice thing about that was using the convolution, we were actually able to obtain certain maps that agreed with observations in the field made previously about particular frequencies being involved into memory load tasks and particular locations where those frequencies would be most present. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have much time to go into all the details here, and I'd be happy to talk about that offline. But that was really very interesting, and I think first-time application of recurrent convolutional networks to EEG data. And we're currently working on applying it to even more natural brain videos, such as functional MRI. Anyway, so it's an intermediate summary. There is more. So this is basically saying that, yes, applying machine learning to neuroimaging can buy you a lot in terms of being predictive and giving you also interpretable models. And those are just a few examples that I mentioned. However, we cannot use a fMRI in real life. So we need to go beyond the scanner. And there is a whole revolution in wearable world. There are new wearables coming out probably almost every day, well, or every week. And there are apparently tons of data being collected. And the question is, what do you do with this data? What kind of inferences can you make from this data? Do they actually have signal, or they are not really measuring anything relevant to, say, mental state? And that's why we decided to experiment with wearable EEG device. It's Interaxon Muse, which is very simple. It only has four electrodes, two frontal, two behind your ears. Very simple, looks like that. So measures all classical five EEG bands, that have some associated function with them. For example, alpha, higher alpha typically means a person is more relaxed or maybe reflecting on something, while higher beta means alert or maybe even anxious. And then we did some experiments in our lab on ourselves and our colleagues. This is not published work, it's just kind of a proof of concept example, that indeed there is some brain-related information even in those very simplistic non-medical grade devices. If you cluster people by their average frequencies, first of all, you see that people tend to cluster close to themselves. They kind of more or less stable, although there were exceptions when a calm person on one day had some issues and looked very different from himself. The other interesting observation, I'm not going to make any generalizations and claims out of that, but somehow several male participants turned out to have actually higher alpha, lower beta, which means they were more relaxed and truly meditating, while all the female participants, including myself, were just the opposite. But again, this is a very inconclusive small subject study. Another study was a little bit more serious, and we had a paper on that published actually last year at a neuroimaging workshop. We decided to continue playing with EEG device at work, and for the science sake, we asked our colleagues to watch movies. Well, they gladly agreed, so we got plenty of subjects, and they were supposed to watch a movie of like Khan Academy versus cat videos. The idea was, can you distinguish between serious, rational thinking and emotional impact? I was actually very surprised when we realized that the results are much higher than chance level, even with this almost like toy device. We were able to get almost 75% accuracy, discriminating not only within the subject, but across the subjects. I was really surprised. I didn't expect that wearables actually could be so predictive about mental state. Although, disclaimer is, it's not clearly designed emotional versus rational thinking, because for some people, Khan Academy videos about a drop in housing prices, and actually increase in housing prices and then drop around 2004, 2006, was much more emotional than whatever cat videos. But whatever it is, we were able to distinguish it. And again, feature selection and interpretability played the role, because the best method was sparse logistic regression, which actually beat deep networks on this data. But disclaimer is, the data were small sample. It's no surprise. And one more example of going beyond scanner is actually work by my colleague Guillermo Cecchi in our group and his multiple collaborators, which I find really fascinating. Using language, text, and speech to reconstruct, to predict mental states. One example shown on picture here is experiment with manics, schizophrenics, controls. They ask to talk about their recent dream. The text is transcribed, and the directed graph is constructed simply using words as nodes, and if word follows the word, you have directed link. You can actually easily eyeball the graphs and see who is who. On the left, you see schizophrenic patient talking in short, disconnected sentences, control telling some story going back to where he started, and manic on the left having order of magnitude more words and bunch of loops coming back to the same topic. Even more interesting result, recent result, was published at Nature Schizophrenia paper last August, where a group of prodromal schizophrenic patients, Columbia University data, were interviewed. Interviews also were transcribed, and they were analyzed for several features such as consistency, basically coherence, lengths of sentences, and other features you can extract from data. Again, there was no sophisticated tools used here, but the essential, the most predictive feature was coherence of speech, which was actually, together with a couple of other features, able to predict who out of the prodromal population going to develop psychotic episode in 1 to 2 years from now. That was really amazing. Other examples include also studying how language can help you discriminate between people in control group versus people who were given ecstasy. As you can imagine, semantic distance in the embedding space, which I'll talk about next slide, is close to compassion and love. Basically, if you take their text and measure the distance, they will be all closer to these words. It gives you also features that can quite accurately discriminate between two types of two groups. And just to mention one kind of funny application, it's not really something kind of we really focused on, but it was just interesting to see what can you get with coherence feature if you analyze not necessarily psychiatric disorders, but just regular people's speech. You go on YouTube, there is a bunch of videos by certain people who are actually having millions of viewers, like Jenna. And on the left, she's just giving her usual discussion of things. On the right, she's drunk, talking about how to apply makeup when you're drunk. So we have labeled data here. So you take the transcribed text, measure sentence-to-sentence coherence, which is very simple measure, no word to vec, nothing deep, very shallow. You do SVD on frequency of words across TASA corpus matrix. You come up with 300-dimensional embedding, average those vectors across a sentence, get a vector, and just see how this vector changes. Larger angle means less coherence. It was quite obvious that her sober and non-sober states can be easily characterized and discriminated by this single feature or maybe skip sentence coherence as well. Anyway, so the point here was also just like in some previous examples, that though complicated machine learning methods sometimes give you an extra edge, the key in such applications is a feature design which reflects something about how things actually work, some domain knowledge. In any case, so the overall vision with all these beyond scanner measurements would be to work towards augmented human, where 24/7 measurements from variables, text and speech could be used to analyze mental state and hopefully provide the feedback and improve mental function. Finally, in the remaining 30 seconds, I would like to go into opposite direction and talk a little bit about recent work, which is not yet published, it only submitted, about brain to AI, where you try to use certain mechanisms in the brain as inspiration for machine learning methods. And at the same time, trying to come up with a computational model of those mechanisms. And one of the fascinating mechanisms is the adult neurogenesis. Like, contrary to the old dogma that was dogma more than 30 years ago, adult brains do grow new neurons. But the question is, why? Why is it computationally advantageous for adult brains to grow new neurons? By the way, they only do it in very specific places. Like in mammals, it's olfactory bulb and dentate gyrus of hippocampus. And in people, it's primarily dentate gyrus in hippocampus. Because probably, unlike rats, we don't really care that much about olfaction and smells, but we do care about memory formation, which what hippocampus does. So our model is quite simple. We use sparse coding, sparse dictionary learning, which can be obviously mapped to sparse linear autoencoder. And we add two steps to it, birth and death of neurons, where the birth is simply depending on how well you're performing, like if the environment changes and you detect that error increases, you generate random projections. Death is simply group sparsity on the dictionary elements. And that's how you try to control growth and death so the network or the dictionary doesn't explode. So we built upon state-of-art in dictionary learning online method by Myral, and we did see considerable improvements due to neurogenetic dictionary learning, especially in cases when the environment, when the input is non-stationary, when it changes from one type of images to another quite drastically. Yeah, I'm running out of time, But I just wanted to conclude with some lessons learned from our experience in this field of brain to AI and AI to brain. As I already mentioned, the main specific priors are always quite helpful, such as group sparsity most of the time. Also, incorporating very accurate analytical models such as pain, I mean temperature to pain, with data-driven approaches gives you an extra edge. That feature engineering, actually based on what you know about domain, is still very important and is not replaced by automated feature construction, at least not in natural sciences. Model interpretability is the key requirement for whatever method you're going to use, be it regression or convolutional network or anything. Stability, reproducibility of models and selected features is essential. Otherwise, we don't know what we learned about the phenomenon at hand. It's also important to go beyond finding one optimal solution and explore the whole space of solutions, because you never know whether there is one optimal and second optimal is so much worse, or there are many optimal solutions and they are all similarly good. And that may tell apart different tasks and different mental states. And finally, as I mentioned, deep learning faces specific challenges in this domain because data sets are still relatively small. Although we were able to do what we did with EEG with a few thousands of samples. So the answer is it's okay not to have millions of samples. You can play with the size of your networks and you can regularize. So you find that balance between your data set size and the number of parameters. And of course, even deep learning approaches should find a way to be interpretable. So at the end of the day, you can present your results to neuroscientists and hopefully you learn something interesting. Thank you. By the way, as I mentioned here, please come to our workshop tomorrow on representation learning in artificial biological neural networks. And I know that the press will be closed, but well, if you're still interested in buying some books, you may check out those too. Any questions?
Yeah, we have some time for a few questions. So.
Yes. Have you looked at neuromagnetometry?
Not really. So we mainly focused on fMRI and EEG. Yeah, we didn't even yet look at MEG and fNIRS. And yes, I'm sure there are various modalities that we didn't explore yet.
So in 1997, I used the superconducting quantum interference device for measuring brain state and had very convincing results, very similar to what you've been doing. Male versus female, DSM, schizophrenia versus bipolar. But it's a good window into the neurochemistry, whereas blood flow may not be quite as compelling.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the Bolt signal is, to put it mildly, very, very indirect measure of neural activity. And just quoting Jack Gallant, yeah, we all hate it, but it's the best thing we have. Yeah. At least that's what he says. Yeah, it's a decent thing. It depends for what kind of questions. Yeah. So there are questions you still should be able to answer even with fMRI, despite its space and time resolution.
Yeah, non-invasive is good.
Non-invasive is good. You can use it on graduate students, yes.
However, the rest of my time I spent with electrodes in mammalian and insect nervous systems, and the data you acquire there is beyond compare. It's frustrating because it's invasive, though.
And you probably cannot really record all the neurons at once, ever.
No, that's true.
Like no whole brain measurements. I actually have to note that calcium imaging is a more recent modality, which is great because it allows you to measure at the time resolution of EEG, and the space resolution where it's a subneuronal voxel size. It's amazing. The only problem, you don't do it on human. The calcium imaging is done on like larval zebrafish and stuff like that. But resolution in both directions is great. Thank you.
One more question. Yeah, we have time maybe for just one more question.
I wonder, have you thought about looking at eye movements? There's work from 2012 by Benson and Sinclair where they show that schizophrenia can be discriminated against control subjects with very high 90% accuracy, and eye movement detection is nicely halfway in between the exotic MRI and the inexpensive wearables. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting study, though I wasn't aware of that. And in a sense, yeah, that probably going to be even cheaper and easier if it's really so accurate. It's a great observation. As to schizophrenia, I also should note, I mean, there are so many studies with different modalities and different approaches, some of them reporting high accuracy. The problem is they are typically done on relatively small subsets of subjects. And that's a problem with all these neuroimaging studies in general, and that's why people are really trying to come up with much larger data set to check generalizability. Because on schizophrenia, there is tons of various studies showing good results, but they're all kind of disconnected in the sense that they're on different sets of subjects under different conditions. So testing generalization of this approach would be great. Thank you.
Fantastic. Let's thank Irina again.